Akhotra Foundation presents the Akhotra Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akhotra AI. Welcome, everyone. Today we're diving into a truly remarkable life story. Imagine this. A young man works as a nightclub bouncer. He loves dancing the tango, trains as a chemist, and then goes on to lead over a billion people worldwide.
It sounds almost unbelievable, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But that's the journey of Jorge Mario Bergoglio, the man who became Pope Francis.
Exactly. And his story is particularly relevant because he hasn't just lived through history, he's actively engaged with it. We're drawing insights today from his memoirs, Life, My Story Through History, and A Life of Service and Transformation.
Right. These aren't just reflections. They place his personal experiences right alongside major world events, from World War II and dictatorships in Argentina to the pandemic. It gives this really unique perspective.
Our goal here is to unpack that perspective, explore the moments that really shaped him, and see what lessons we can pull out about leadership, about faith, about just navigating this constantly changing world.
Yeah, because whether you're religious or not, his life touches on these universal themes: finding purpose, dealing with failure, leading authentically. Things, frankly, we all grapple with.
Absolutely. So let's start at the beginning. Who was Jorge Bergoglio before the world knew him as Francis? What were those formative years like?
Well, he was born in Buenos Aires, Argentina, back in 1936. Flores, a middle-class area. His parents were Italian immigrants. His dad, an accountant. His mom, a homemaker. Eldest of five kids.
So a fairly typical immigrant family background for that time in Argentina. Hard work, frugality.
Very much so. Mm-hmm. And deeply Catholic. But the memoirs paint this picture of a normal kid, too. Loved soccer, played in the streets. It wasn't all piety from day one.
And there was a key figure early on, wasn't there? His grandmother.
Oh, absolutely pivotal. His paternal grandmother, Rosa Vassallo. She sounds incredible. She taught him Piedmontese, the regional Italian dialect, shared all that heritage. But more than that, she instilled this very practical, lived-in kind of faith.
What do you mean by practical?
Well, less about abstract rules, more about compassion and action, caring for neighbors, that sort of thing. And she'd resisted fascism back in Italy, so she was this model of, moral courage right from the start. A huge influence.
It's fascinating because his path after that wasn't exactly direct. She wasn't the kid everyone pegged as a future priest.
Not at all. And the memoirs are quite open about this. He worked as a bouncer, can you imagine? And a chemical technician, a janitor.
Those jobs must have given him such a different perspective on life, on working class struggles.
Definitely. Grounded him, you could say. Gave him an ability to connect with people from all walks of life later on. Plus, he was an avid reader, loved his football club, San Lorenzo. He even had a girlfriend, enjoyed dancing tango.
Okay, so he's this multifaceted young man experiencing life.
Yeah.
Then what happens? What shifts?
The first major, major turning point comes when he's 17, September 21st, 1953. Feast of St. Matthew. Mm. He goes to confession. And he describes it as a lightning bolt moment, a profound spiritual experience where he felt, in his words, called by name. It just made the idea of religious life, well, inevitable for him.
Wow, that's intense.
Incredibly. And it completely shaped his understanding of mercy and forgiveness. You see it directly in his papal motto later, Miserando atque elegendo. By having mercy and by choosing. It all ties back to that moment.
So that sets the direction. But then another major challenge hits him physically, right?
Yes. A few years later, at 21, this is 1957, he gets incredibly sick with severe pleurisy. It's an inflammation affecting the lungs.
How bad was it?
Bad enough that they had to surgically remove part of his right lung. I mean, that's that's a brush with mortality.
Absolutely. How did that impact him beyond the physical recovery?
He talks about it as more than just medical. It was existential.
Yeah.
Spiritual. He felt the fragility of life firsthand. But also, crucially, the power of human compassion. He often mentions a nurse who was particularly kind. It forced him to confront those ultimate questions about life purpose.
And did that solidify his decision to enter the priesthood?
It seems so. But not as an escape,
Yeah.
More like a deeper commitment because of that vulnerability. Mm. To serve precisely because he understood fragility. It's quite profound when you think about it.
It really is. It makes you reflect on how our own moments of vulnerability, those unexpected difficulties, can actually shape our direction. Maybe even clarify our calling.
So he enters the Jesuit novitiate in 1958. This is a period of intense study, spiritual formation. And happens to coincide with the Second Vatican Council.
Which was huge for the Catholic Church, a real moment of opening up to the modern world.
Exactly. And Vatican II becomes the theological bedrock for his entire ministry. dialogue, social justice, the church engaging with the world. Mm. It's all there. He's ordained in 69 and starts working in these working class parishes. That commitment to the peripheries, the margins, starts right there.
Okay, so his path is clearer now, but then comes a really difficult and frankly controversial chapter, his time as Jesuit provincial in Argentina.
Right. He's appointed provincial superior at just 36 in 1973. And this is during Argentina's dirty war, starting seriously in 76 under the military dictatorship. A truly brutal, dark period. Kidnappings, disappearances, state terror.
And he faced accusations related to that time, specifically concerning two Jesuit priests who were kidnapped.
He did, Orlando Iorio and Franz Jelix. The memoirs address this head on. He firmly denies any complicity, detailing how he worked behind the scenes secretly to try and save people, hiding them, helping them get out of the country.
It's a complex situation to navigate for anyone, let alone a young leader.
Incredibly complex. But what's really insightful and quite self-aware of the memoirs is his admission about his leadership style then.
What does he say?
He admits it was sometimes authoritarian, making decisions on the spot, maybe not consulting enough, which alienated some people. He calls it a trial by fire, even a defining failure.
Wow, that's candid.
It is. And he explicitly says he learned painful lessons from it, about the limits of his judgment, about the need for a more consultative approach.
Yeah.
You can see how that would shape his later leadership, especially dealing with the complexities of the Vatican.
That really speaks to learning from mistakes, even massive ones, under immense pressure. So after that period as provincial, what happened?
Well, after his term ended, things shifted. In the early 90s, he was essentially sent away from the centers of Jesuit power in Argentina to Córdoba. He calls it a time of interior exile.
Exile, why?
It was partly due to tensions stemming from his time as provincial, maybe his leadership style then. He felt isolated, misunderstood, a period of great desolation, as he puts it.
That sounds incredibly difficult, almost like a punishment.
He frames it differently now, though, as a necessary purification, kind of dark night of the soul, where he had to confront his own pride, his ambition, his past mistakes.
So a painful period, but ultimately transformative.
Exactly. He says it taught him humility, patience, and crucially, the importance of Ignatian discernment, that practice of careful, prayerful decision-making, listening, consulting. It wasn't just a setback. It was where immense spiritual growth happened. It prepared him, in a way, for what was to come.
It's a powerful reminder, isn't it, that sometimes those periods where we feel sidelined or like we failed are actually crucibles for future growth, if we let them be.
Absolutely. And emerged from that crucible, he did. In 1992, he's appointed Auxiliary Bishop of Buenos Aires,
yeah,
then Archbishop in 98.
And this is when he really becomes known as the Bishop of the Slums, right?
Yes, the Villas Miserias. Mm. He becomes famous for his simple lifestyle, taking public transport, living in a small apartment, really being present with the poor and marginalized. His leadership during Argentina's big economic crisis around 2001 really cemented that reputation.
People saw him as authentic, as someone who understood their struggles.
Definitely. Then Pope John Paul II makes him a cardinal in 2001. And through all this, you see his core philosophy solidifying.
Let's talk about that philosophy. What's at the heart of it, based on his life and these memoirs?
Number one, I'd say, is the primacy of mercy. This is huge for him. The church as a field hospital for the wounded, not some exclusive club for the perfect.
Going out to the peripheries, as he says.
Exactly. Geographically, but also existentially, people who feel excluded, lost, wounded.
Yeah.
His whole approach is geared towards that. He often says God's style is closeness, mercy, and tenderness. It's very relational.
What else stands out?
His dialogical approach. He's constantly talking about building bridges, not walls. Fostering a culture of encounter.
Encounter.
Yeah, actually looking people in the eye, listening deeply, trying to understand their perspective, even if you disagree. It applies to ecumenism, interreligious dialogue, everything. It's about connection over conflict.
And there's that Jesuit idea of discernment, too.
Right, discernment. Not seeing the world in black and white, trusting that God works in complexity and the gray areas. It requires patience, listening, weighing things carefully. It's linked to his famous call for young people to make a mess, Hagen Leo.
Which isn't about causing chaos, is it?
No, not destructive chaos. It's about challenging the status quo, questioning assumptions, not being afraid of the messiness of trying to live out the gospel in the real world. Don't just cling to safety and rigid rules. Engage with life's complexities.
So mercy, encounter, discernment. What fundamentally drives him? What are his core motivations?
Well, underlying everything is a deep personal relationship with Jesus Christ. It's very much a faith built on relationship, not just rules. Then there's his passion for the poor, clearly forged in those Buenos Aires slums. Social justice isn't an add-on for him. It's essential to the gospel.
And the desire for church reform.
Absolutely. He wants to fully realize the vision of Vatican II, dismantle what he sees as clericalism, that sense of clergy entitlement or superiority, and build a more synodal church.
Synodal meaning?
Walking together. Clergy, laity, everyone listening to each other and discerning the path forward collectively. Right. He talks about a holy unrest driving this desire for renewal.
Okay, so this whole life, these experiences, this philosophy, it all culminates in Rome in 2013.
The conclave, yeah. After Pope Benedict VI's historic resignation, Bergoglio travels there, apparently with just a small suitcase, thinking he'll be back in Buenos Aires soon.
But the votes start coming his way. What was that like for him?
He describes a mix of fear and peace. And then there's that incredibly poignant moment he shares in the memoirs.
The whisper.
The whisper. His friend, the Brazilian Cardinal Claudio Hummes, leans over as the votes are confirming his election and whispers, "Don't forget the poor."
Wow.
And Francis says right then, that phrase solidified his choice of name. Francis. After seeing Francis of Assisi, the saint of poverty, peace, creation, dialogue, it just clicked.
It's amazing how that single phrase connected everything his past, his passions, the call he was receiving.
It really is. A lifetime converging in a moment. An unexpected call, but one he was perhaps uniquely prepared for.
So now we have Pope Francis. Let's shift to the three most pivotal turning points we've touched on. First, that confession at 17. Why was that so critical?
It was the foundational call. Before that, priesthood wasn't necessarily the plan. That intense experience of God's mercy and election, feeling called by name, fundamentally reoriented his entire life and defined his core spiritual understanding. Everything flows from that encounter with mercy.
Okay, second turning point. The lung illness at 21.
Right. This wasn't just overcoming sickness. It was a deep dive into vulnerability, mortality, and the power of compassion. It stripped away youthful invincibility and solidified his vocation, not as seeking power or perfection, but as serving from a place of shared human fragility. It deepened his empathy immeasurably.
And the third pivotal moment.
I'd say the 2013 conclave and election itself. It represents the convergence of his entire life's journey. The lessons from Argentina, the exile, the focus on the poor, the desire for a merciful church into this unexpected global role. The whisper, "Don't forget the poor," and his choice of name encapsulated everything he'd become and signaled the kind of papacy he intended to lead. It was the moment his personal history became world history.
Those are powerful markers. Now, as Pope, he's faced enormous challenges. How does he handle adversity? What's his approach?
One phrase he uses is creative patience. He knows reform takes time and meets resistance. He faced and faces stiff opposition from within the church structure, the curia. He calls it a slow, tenacious battle.
Especially on issues like the sexual abuse crisis.
Absolutely. He inherited a deeply wounded church. He's committed publicly to zero tolerance, transparency, accountability, cultural change. Though he's also faced criticism about the pace or effectiveness of those reforms. He's admitted errors, like in the Bishop Barros case in Chile, and publicly repented. It's ongoing.
And he doesn't shy away from global political tensions either, does he? On migration, climate change.
Not at all. He advocates strongly for refugees, for environmental protection, for global cooperation, even when it draws criticism from political figures or certain groups. He seemed to view adversity, even opposition, as something to be expected, maybe even as an opportunity for purification, for clarifying the mission. That creative patience is key, enduring, but always looking for ways forward.
We talked about his grandmother, but who else really shaped him? Any key relationships or mentors?
Well, besides Rosa, he mentions Esther Balestrino de Cariaga. She was his boss at the chemical lab where he worked as a young man. Interestingly, she was a communist and a Paraguayan activist. He says she taught him methodical work discipline, but also deepened his social conscience.
That's fascinating. A communist influencing a future pope's social thinking.
Shows his openness to learning from unexpected sources, doesn't it? Then there was Father Miguel Angel Fiorito, his spiritual director, who really grounded him in that Ignatian discernment practice we mentioned.
And collaborators now.
He set up the Council of Cardinals, the C9, to advise him on reform. He worked closely with Fabio Marchese Ragona on the life memoir, and he consistently spoke of his deep respect and affection for his predecessor, Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI, calling him a father and a brother.
The memoirs also touch on rivalries, though, right? Without maybe naming everyone explicitly.
Yes. He alludes to internal divisions, sometimes within the Jesuits back in Argentina, or what he calls the courteous demons in the Vatican people, who resist reform politely but firmly. and there have been public critics, like Archbishop Vigano. He seems to frame this opposition as, well, part of the territory when you're trying to enact significant change, a spiritual trial almost.
So, looking at his papacy, what does he hope his professional legacy will be? What are the concrete changes?
Reform is central. The big one is the restructuring of the Roman Curia with that document, Praedicat Evangelium.
Mm-hmm.
The goal is to make it less of a central command and more of a service body for the global church, decentralizing power.
And finances.
Yes. Efforts towards financial transparency, cleaning up the Vatican Bank, the IOR, that's been a major undertaking. And maybe most fundamentally championing synodality.
That walking together idea again.
Exactly. Trying to embed a culture of listening and shared discernment deep into the church's structures. It's a long-term project, potentially transformative if it takes root.
Beyond the institutional church, what's his wider cultural or societal impact been?
Huge. Laudato Si, in 2015, on the environment linking the cry of the earth and the cry of the poor, was groundbreaking. It shifted the global conversation, putting environmental protection squarely in the moral and spiritual sphere.
And Fratelli Tutti.
That came in 2020, a powerful call for social friendship and universal fraternity, pushing back against rising nationalism and populism. He's become this major global voice on peace, migration, economic justice. Arguably one of the most significant moral leaders on the world stage today.
And then there's the human legacy. How has he changed the image of the papacy?
Dramatically, I think. He swapped that image of a distant monarch for a compassionate pastor. His simple lifestyle, living in the Casa Santa Marta guest house, not the Apostolic Palace, the old Ford Focus, it all sends a powerful message. A poor church for the poor.
The smell like his sheep idea.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And his emphasis on mercy, that non-judgmental, who am I to judge, line that caught so much attention early on, plus his willingness to talk about his own doubts, his past failures. It models a vulnerability that's very relatable, very human.
There's some great anecdotes too, aren't there? Like calling his newsstand?
Yeah. Right after being elected Pope, he personally calls his news vendor back in Buenos Aires to cancel his newspaper subscription. It's such a small thing, but it speaks volumes about his desire to stay grounded, humble.
So as we start to wrap up, let's pull out some universal lessons from this incredible life. Yeah. What does Pope Francis's journey teach us?
One huge takeaway is that failure is formative, not final. His difficult time as provincial, the exile in Cordoba, these weren't dead ends. They were essential learning experiences that forged the leader he became. It reminds me of that Portuguese proverb he loves, God writes straight with crooked lines. The detours are the path.
That's powerful. What else?
The importance of the peripheries. His life constantly pushes us to look towards the margins, whether geographical or social or personal. True understanding, compassion, justice, they're found when we engage with those who are overlooked. It's a challenge to all of us. Where are our peripheries?
And the emphasis on dialogue.
Yes, dialogue over ideology. Learning from his communist boss, his constant outreach across religious divides, he models choosing connection and listening over rigid certainty. In a polarized world, that's a critical lesson. Seek to understand the person, not just win the argument.
Okay, so failure is formative. Engage the peripheries. Dialogue over ideology. Anything else?
Maybe that call to embrace the mess. Make a mess, Hagan Leo. Don't be paralyzed by fear of imperfection or complexity. Engage with the world. Challenge things that need changing. Trust that God works even in the ambiguity and chaos. It's an invitation to courageous, authentic living.
These are really profound lessons. It really makes you think, doesn't it? How can you, listening now, apply these ideas about leadership, humility, failure, and dialogue in your own sphere of influence? So we've journeyed through the remarkable life of Pope Francis from those early days in Buenos Aires, through hardship and controversy, right up to the global stage. We've seen how his personal story and the currents of history intertwined to shape this leader who consistently calls us towards mercy, encounter, and justice.
It really is an extraordinary narrative. Mm-hmm. And the memoirs give such an intimate view. You see a leader whose strength seems to come precisely from acknowledging his own humanity, mm-hmm. his own struggles, and constantly pointing back to a message of hope and compassion, even amidst global crises.
Let's leave you with a final thought to ponder. Pope Francis challenges us constantly to consider the peripheries in our own lives, the edges, the margins, both out there in the world and maybe within ourselves too. So the question is, where are your margins? And what might you discover if you dared to journey towards them with mercy, with an open heart, trusting as he does that even through crooked lines, a beautiful story is being written? Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.